Chapter 8. So, what is AIDS? Los Angeles, California, 1980. The man of 33 years being examined by Dr. Michael Gottlieb is deteriorating quickly. His fever refuses to go away, as do an active cytomegalovirus, CMV infection in the blood and liver problems. Soon his immune system collapses to the point that native microbes, ones that have lived at peace with him for more than 3 decades, begin eating away at his body. Pneumocystis carinii and candida, germs that normally reside in all humans and most mammals, now take over the patient. The former germ grows into a severe pneumonia. The latter establishes a thick yeast infection that begins choking his throat. By May 3rd, the following year, the young artist has died. The autopsy revealing a CMV infection in his lung that was hidden by the pneumocystis pneumonia. This patient gained the dubious distinction of being the first officially recorded AIDS case in history, one of the 5 reported by the CDC in June 1981. Gottlieb had dutifully noted that the man was an active homosexual who admitted using poppers, the aphrodisiac nitrate inhalant so popular in the homosexual bathhouses and discos of major cities. Kenya, Africa, several years later. The hospital that the foreign woman enters is considered better than the few clinics in surrounding areas. She needs the best care medicine can provide. Only 39 years old, she has just arrived from Zaire, desperate to find treatment for her lung condition. It had begun with a relatively innocent cough and an unexpected drop in weight. Soon, her coughs began bringing up blood. Tuberculosis is the diagnosis of the Kenyan doctor. But the patient has a strong allergic reaction to the drugs he prescribes. Her condition progresses from bad to worse, adding diarrhea, uncontrollable fever, swollen lymph nodes, and anemic blood disorders to her list of symptoms. But while the tuberculosis takes over, the pneumocystis and candida microbes also residing in her body remain perfectly hidden, causing no complications. She represents in every way the typical African AIDS patient. The woman's husband, staying in the same hospital, suffers something entirely different and more unusual. Doctors assume he must have transmitted AIDS to his wife, though his diseases bear no similarity to hers. He has some sort of pneumonia, as well as a candida yeast infection in his mouth and lesions of Kaposi sarcoma, a blood vessel tumor on his now irregularly pigmented skin. For African patients, this tumor appears so rarely it is almost totally unknown. He loses weight to a relentless diarrhea and is constantly fighting off episodes of gonorrhea. He knows he is on his deathbed. Oddly enough, their children have no such medical troubles. According to the public health officials directing our war on AIDS, the male homosexual in Los Angeles and the Zairean couple all suffered the same disease. But did they? Each person was affected with radically different diseases. A pneumocystis pneumonia, a tuberculosis, a Kaposi sarcoma, conditions that in the past would never have been connected by medical doctors. The only common factor between these patients was the presence in each of antibodies against HIV. At least that is the presumption. Gottlieb's first AIDS case was never actually tested since the virus had not yet been discovered. And African AIDS patients are routinely diagnosed for AIDS without ever conducting an HIV test. A glance at the statistics proves that AIDS is not one but several totally different epidemics and is 30 in part totally different diseases under one name. The global AIDS empire is held together only by its name and the hypothesis that it is caused by HIV. Epidemics in different parts of the world are the same if the same diseases are observed in the same groups of people. For example, if lung cancer occurs in smokers in America and in Africa, and if the sex ratio of these lung cancers reflects the sex ratio of smokers, the cancers of both continents are part of the same epidemic. But the statistics reveal the unbridgeable gaps between the AIDS epidemics in America and in Africa. Since 1985, official estimates have placed the number of HIV-positive Americans at around 1 million, of which some 260,000 had developed AIDS by the end of 1991, and about 400,000 by the end of 1994. 9 of every 10 cases occur in men. Most AIDS victims are older than 20 years, and a few are infants, but virtually no teenagers have been affected. Male homosexuals make up 62% of American AIDS patients, intravenous drug users and their children another 32%, and hemophiliacs and other blood transfusion patients remain at 3%. The balance of 3% represents the CDC's other categories, which is the normal low background of AIDS-defining diseases in the general population of America. While nearly two-thirds, 62%, of American AIDS diseases do fit the popular image of opportunistic infections caused by microbes taking advantage of decimated immune systems, the remaining one-third, 38%, do not. Kaposi sarcoma, dementia, weight loss, wasting disease, and lymphoma can even strike people with healthy immune systems. The remaining one-third, 38%, do not. Kaposi sarcoma, dementia, weight loss, wasting disease, and lymphoma can even strike people with healthy immune systems. These are non-microbial and non-contagious diseases whose causes are not dependent on the immune system. The African picture stands in sharp contrast. Also tested for HIV since 1985, 6 to 8 million, 8 times as many Africans as Americans are infected. Yet the entire continent has produced fewer AIDS cases, 129,000 by 1992, and exactly 345,639 by December 1994. Women overall are diagnosed as often as men. No particular age group seems to be singled out by the syndrome, nor can risk groups be easily defined by sexual activity or identifiable health risks. Despite the universal presence of pneumocystis and candida microbes in Africans, as in all world populations, these germs do not dominate the African AIDS statistics as they do in the industrial world. Instead, tuberculosis and the fevers and diarrheas associated with parasitic infections show up most commonly. Even their slim disease appears to be a different sort of wasting condition than is found in the United States or Europe. The African but not the American wasting diseases are associated with parasitic infections. And Kaposi sarcoma, which now strikes 10% of American AIDS victims, appears in only 2% of African cases. The pulmonary Kaposi sarcoma, a lung cancer that manifests itself in a third of all American Kaposi's patients, has never been diagnosed in Africans nor ever in the United States or Europe before AIDS. To find the cause of AIDS, therefore, one must define the health risks common to each separate group. Since this syndrome is not spreading outside of any AIDS risk group, the causes must be non-infectious. A contagious disease, by definition, spreads into the general population, as do all microbes. As witnessed in the past, non-contagious causes of disease can include medically prescribed drugs, as was the case with SMON, vitamin or other nutritional deficiencies, as with scurvy, pellagra, and beriberi, or long-term recreational drug use. For example, long-term use of tobacco causes lung cancer and emphysema, and long-term use of alcohol causes liver cirrhosis. The infectious AIDS paradigm cannot explain why, one, in Africa, AIDS is not new and is not infectious, two, in the United States and Europe, most AIDS cases do reflect an independent increase in opportunistic infections, Kaposi sarcoma, weight loss, and dementia, but one that has coincided tightly with the explosion in heavy drug use. This is why AIDS is restricted to risk groups, male homosexuals using sexual stimulants for years, and intravenous drug users. And three, hemophiliacs and blood transfusion recipients are not dying from HIV. Instead, hemophiliacs suffer from immunosuppression caused by the long-term transfusion of blood products and from immunosuppressive treatments with anti-AIDS drugs like AZT. Transfusion recipients die from diseases that necessitated the transfusions regardless of the presence of HIV. Drug use and AIDS. The same epidemic? Virtually everyone's life has been directly impacted by the drug use epidemic, the only new health risk of the Western world since World War II. Most people in the industrial world either have tried an illicit drug or know others who have. Just one or two generations ago, high schools spent their time trying to control cigarette smoking in the restrooms. In those same restrooms today, students can find a laundry list of recreational drugs for smoking, swallowing, snorting, or even injecting. The 1960s gained the reputation as the decade of freely available drugs, especially marijuana and psychedelics. But in reality, the widespread escalation in drug use began largely during the Vietnam War, about a decade before the appearance of AIDS. Much of the explosion has taken place only in recent years. Overall drug arrests in the United States totaled approximately 450,000 in 1980, according to the Bureau of Justice Statistics, and the total was up to 1.4 million by 1989. Heroin-related arrests roughly tripled during the 1970s, corresponding with a jump in the number of heroin overdose victims. In the decade 1976 to 1985, the number of addicts admitted to hospitals doubled and then doubled again. During 1985, some 580 injection drug addicts died in hospitals, increasing to 2,483 such deaths by 1990. Between 1992 and 1993, heroin-related hospital emergencies increased 44%, based on data from the Department of Health and Human Services. The situation with cocaine looks even more grim. More than 5 million Americans had tried the drug by 1974, but 11 years later, this figure had jumped to 22 million. Currently, about 8 million Americans are regular users of cocaine. By the mid-1980s, crack, an addictive smokable form of cocaine, evolved into an epidemic among poor young adults of minority groups. A recent national household survey of drug use found that 1 million Americans between 18 and 25 years of age had used crack during the previous year. Unlike injected cocaine, which is predominantly consumed by men, the use of crack is widespread among both men and women. The Drug Enforcement Administration confiscated about 500 kilograms of cocaine in 1980, 9,000 in 1983, 80,000 in 1989, and 100,000 in 1990, a total increase of 20,000% in one decade. During that same time, the number of cocaine overdose victims admitted to hospitals also exploded, from slightly more than 3,000 in 1981 to more than 120,000 in 1993, a 4,000% jump. And direct cocaine-related deaths increased more than tenfold from 1980 to 1990. Law enforcement agencies seized some 2 million doses of amphetamines in 1981, but caught some 97 million doses just 8 years later in 1989. Alkanitrates, used primarily as aphrodisiacs, became popular during the 1970s, escalating into a popper craze in the 1980s. The National Institute on Drug Abuse estimated that by 1980, some 5 million Americans were inhaling the drug at least once a week. By 1978, the once tiny poppers industry was already grossing $50 million in annual profits, a figure that continued to climb. Poppers manufacturers even became the largest source of advertising revenue to such homosexual magazines as The Advocate, which in turn ignored the efforts of some public health authorities and activists to warn homosexual men of the dangerous effects of poppers. Naturally, one might expect major health problems in the wake of this drug explosion. If the timing of the AIDS epidemic following on the heels of the drug epidemic was no coincidence, then one should also find the spread of AIDS following the spread of drug use. Not only did the drug use epidemic take off shortly before AIDS appeared, but it hit hardest among precisely the same risk groups. The parallels are astounding. Both AIDS and drug use, for example, are concentrated in younger men. Between 1983 and 1987, the death rate among American men ages 25 to 44 increased by about 10,000 deaths per year, the same as the average number of AIDS deaths per year in that time period. But also during the 1980s, deaths from drug overdoses doubled in men of exactly the same ages, while deaths from blood poisoning, an indirect consequence of injecting drugs, quadrupled. During that same period, AIDS deaths sharply increased among New York injection drug addicts, as did deaths from blood poisoning or other pneumonias, both at exactly the same rate. 90% of all AIDS cases occur in men, but 9 of every 10 people arrested for possession of hard drugs are also male. Even the age distributions coincide perfectly. Men between the ages of 20 and 44 make up 72% of AIDS cases, just as they make up 75% of people arrested or treated for use of hard drugs. What can be said of drug use in the AIDS risk groups? The fact that injection drug users make up 1/3 of American AIDS cases, more than 130,000 by the end of 1993, should give pause for thought. Consider how that number breaks down. This figure includes 3/4 of all heterosexual AIDS cases and more than 2/3 of all female AIDS cases. More than 2/3 of all babies with AIDS are born to mothers who inject drugs. Even 10% of the hemophiliac AIDS cases inject drugs. These statistics incorporate only self-reported drug injection, for they cannot confirm such illegal habits in people who will not admit to them. And more important, most drugs are inhaled or taken orally, not intravenously. The CDC, however, does not ask AIDS patients about non-intravenous drug use. It is more concerned about possible HIV contamination on the injection equipment, hence the clean needle programs. But heroin or cocaine itself is most likely more dangerous than the dirty needles through which it is passed. The remaining AIDS cases occur mostly among male homosexuals, the group that originally defined the epidemic. But the homosexuals who get AIDS form a special subset, sexually hyperactive and often promiscuous men, the so-called fast-track homosexuals. Their lifestyle emerged during the 1970s together with the new drug use epidemic in the bathhouses, discotheques, and sex clubs. These men accumulated hundreds or even thousands of sexual contacts within just a few years. Venereal diseases and exotic parasites spread like wildfire. Infectious diseases ranging from the flu to hepatitis B became commonplace, and heavy doses of antibiotics were taken by many each night before sex just to prevent unsightly sores or acne. Such extreme sexual activity cannot be done on a cup of coffee alone or even on natural testosterone. The fast-track lifestyle required liberal drug use, stimulants to get going, poppers to allow anal intercourse, downers to unwind afterward. Several drugs combined with alcohol and marijuana became par for the course of an evening, a routine that would go on for years. One homosexual man, a math professor in New York who has witnessed the fast-track scene, described the situation in a 1993 letter to Duisberg. The letter is a testimony to the high-risk lifestyle behind AIDS. From my experience in the New York City and Fire Island gay communities, I can testify that more than 1,000, an ever-increasing number, of my acquaintances have been diagnosed with HIV/AIDS over the past decade. Unfortunately, some 250, an estimate it could be greater, of these are now prematurely dead. I have a list of my friends and acquaintances who died under the HIV/AIDS diagnosis. There are 150 names on the list. The remarkable thing about the people on this list and the hundreds of people living with an HIV diagnosis who presently come in and out of my life, sometimes daily, sometimes weekly, is that they almost all have a drug, recreational and medical use, and an alcohol use history of duration of often more than 10 years. Most of the people on my list abused some, if not all, of the following drugs used recreationally: alcohol, amyl nitrate, barbiturates, butyl nitrate, cocaine, crack, ecstasy, XTC, heroin, Librium, LSD, Mandrax, MDA, MDM, mescaline, methamphetamine, mushrooms, PCP, purple haze, Quaalude, Seconal, Special K, THC, Tuinol, and Valium. Most of the people on the list hosted many diseases, and some of these diseases more than once. Candida albicans, chlamydia, cytomegalovirus, cryptosporidiosis, Epstein-Barr virus, gonorrhea, giardia, hepatitis A or B or C or D, herpes simplex, both 1 and 2, herpes zoster, gay bowel syndrome, scabies, venereal warts, and other parasites. In almost all these cases, the diseases were contracted before an HIV-positive diagnosis. I know that my acquaintances ingested large amounts of various antibiotics, antifungals, and antiparasitics. Some used antibiotics before going out for sex as prophylaxis against sexually transmitted diseases. These antibiotics were routinely given to them by gay doctors familiar with the fast lane scene. Of course, after HIV diagnosis, the overwhelming majority of these people used antibiotics, antifungals, antivirals, ACT, DDL, DDC, D4T, Aciclovir, ganaciclovir, etc., as a matter of course, in various combinations over varying intervals of time. At gay discos, both in New York City and on Fire Island, the use of recreational drugs is prevalent. The most common drugs are cocaine, ecstasy, poppers, and Special K. On weekends on Fire Island, drug dealers hawk their goods on the beach and on the walks as well as announce their hotel room numbers. Drug consumption among the fast-track gays is de rigueur. I emphasize that my remarks on drug usage are my observations or they were related directly to me by the individuals involved. They are not judgments. As a result of these observations, I am inclined towards the Duisburg drug AIDS hypothesis. One Texas doctor, while studying AIDS risk factors among his patients in the early 1980s, discovered some of the dangerous practices in the bathhouses. As an example, one of the drugs used was the readily available ethylene chloride, he wrote. I was curious as to how this could be utilized for a high until it was explained to me that a group formed a circle, saturated a towel, and then passed it from person to person for deep inhalation, which certainly seemed an excellent way to transmit disease to me. On the West Coast, AIDS activist William Bryan Coyle now battles the AIDS and HIV dogma. He has painted a similar picture of the fast-track life. These were the gayest of years, but the question is, were they a bit too gay? In deciding to party and celebrate our newly obtained freedom, where would the limits be set? How much partying? How many cocktails? Would that be just on the weekends or 7 days a week? These decisions were, of course, up to each individual. However, the tendency by most to want to be social and sexual would lead most gay men to either a gay bar, a gay dance club, or the baths. For many, the choice became regular visits to the infamous bathhouses, whether it was the main plan for an evening or the finale to an assorted night of gay bars and discos. Whatever the case, it was usually routine to use one or more mood-elevating substances to enhance this social-sexual experience. Substances frequently chosen included cocaine, quaaludes, amphetamines, LSD, MDA, amyl nitrate, and of course, marijuana and alcohol. The combined recipe for an evening might possibly involve four or five of these, and in this depressed state, the sexual exposure to one or more person's germs would occur, and an increased tendency toward indiscriminate additional promiscuity due to distorted judgment capabilities. Some men would use poppers 30 to 40 times while dancing, and then additionally at home or at the baths during their post-disco sexual liaison. As the market grew and bootleg amyl nitrate was now available in half-ounce screw-top glass bottles, it was not uncommon to be in a disco where someone had either accidentally or deliberately spilled a quantity on the dance floor, intoxicating everyone in reach. So many of the poor souls deteriorating so rapidly with AIDS had gone from illegal recreational drug abuse directly into multiple daily prescribed drug abuse, such as AZT. I, for one, will not be another statistic. Coyle credits ending his drug use, his objection to AZT, and paying careful attention to his diet to help control yeast infections for his gradually improving health. He has even found the energy to write his own book, currently in progress. Larry Kramer, the volatile homosexual rights and AIDS activist who founded the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, ACT UP, has himself criticized the excesses of fast-track living. A playwright and author by profession, he used his 1978 novel Faggots to lament the emptiness of anonymous homosexual activity. His book described the intense sexual promiscuity in the bathhouses, a lifestyle that could never be separated from the endless drug use on which it depended. Indeed, Kramer specifically listed many of the most popular drugs. MDA, MDM, THC, PCP, STP, DMT, LDK, WDW, Coke, Windowpane, Blotter, Orange Sunshine, Sweet Pea, Sky Blue, Christmas Tree, Mescaline, Dust, Benjadrine, Dexedrine, Dexamil, Dexoxin, Strychnine, Ionamin, Ritalin, Desbutol, Optitol, Glue, Ethyl Chloride, Nitrous Oxide, Cristomethadrine, Clodidil, Nesperin, Titch, Nestex, Black Beauty, Certain, Preludin with B-112, Zale, Quaalude, Tweenol, Nembutol, Secanol, Amitol, Phenobarb, Elavil, Valium, Librium, Darvon, Mandrax, Opium, Stidel, Halidex, Caldfin, Optimil, Drail. Years passed before AIDS forced the homosexual community as a whole to acknowledge Kramer's point. Medical physicians and researchers have also described the drug problem rampant among many homosexuals. A surprising guest editorial appeared in a 1985 issue of the Wall Street Journal, co-written by a journalist and a Washington, D.C. doctor, Cesar Caceres. The two authors cited official CDC AIDS statistics as well as Caceres' own patients to argue that drug use was so universal among AIDS patients that HIV could not be considered the syndrome's primary cause. AIDS patients, they protested, have pre-existing immune damage from years of drug use, without which AIDS cannot occur. In a direct challenge to the AIDS research establishment, they rhetorically asked, "Since drug abuse can severely damage the immune system, why has AIDS been identified primarily with sex, especially sex among homosexuals?" Joan McKenna, an AIDS therapist from Berkeley, California, described similar drug use patterns among 100 homosexual men in her medical practice. "We found nearly universal use of marijuana, a multiple and complex use of LSD, MDA, PCP, heroin, cocaine, amylin, butyl nitrates, amphetamines, barbiturates, ethyl chloride, opium, mushrooms, and what are referred to as designer drugs." John Lauritsen and Hank Wilson noted that leaders of people with AIDS who have known hundreds of PWAs state that most of them were heavily into drugs and all of them used poppers, and that the owner of a prominent homosexual sex club in New York candidly admitted, "I really don't know anybody who's had AIDS who hasn't used drugs." Large-scale studies of fast-track homosexual volunteers confirm these descriptions. An early CDC study interviewing more than 400 homosexual men recruited from venereal disease clinics counted 86% of them as using poppers frequently. Another study of 170 such men found that 96% admitted inhaling poppers regularly, while most had also used cocaine, amphetamines, lysergic acid, and methaqualone. Many also had taken phencyclidine, ethyl chloride, barbiturates, and heroin. A study of more than 350 homosexual men from San Francisco discovered that more than 80% used cocaine and poppers, with a majority simultaneously consuming other hard drugs. And a similar Boston study of more than 200 HIV-infected homosexual men revealed that 92% inhaled poppers and 75% used cocaine in addition to the usual laundry list of drugs. Among male homosexuals, AIDS patients, more than 95% typically admitted to popper inhalation. By comparison, fewer than 1% of all heterosexuals or lesbians used poppers. In these and other studies, HIV-positive men had always used more drugs than had uninfected men, and sexual activity was tightly linked to heavy drug use. In 1993, everyone in a group of 205 male homosexual AIDS patients from San Francisco reported the use of nitrate inhalants in addition to cocaine and amphetamines. Moreover, 84% of these men were on AZT. A parallel study from Vancouver showed in 1993 that virtually every male homosexual AIDS patient had used nitrates, cocaine, amphetamines, and AZT. Recreational drugs including cocaine, amphetamines, and again AZT were also the common denominator of all male homosexual AIDS patients from a group in Vancouver, Canada. Drugs have also brought babies into the AIDS epidemic. A small percentage of the total AIDS cases, infants tend to suffer from their own peculiar spectrum of AIDS symptoms, such as bacterial infections and mental retardation. These symptoms read like the profile of crack babies and is no coincidence. In his book, And the Band Played On, Randy Schiltz revealed which babies were getting AIDS. Whatever the homosexuals had that was giving them Kaposi's sarcoma and pneumocystis, he noted ominously, it was also spreading among drug addicts and most tragically their children. Except that these young victims did not get Kaposi's sarcomas, lymphomas, or various other diseases common to homosexual AIDS cases. 2/3 of these children have had mothers who inject drugs. Some large percentage of the rest have mothers snorting cocaine or otherwise using non-injected drugs. But only a few studies have reported identical syndromes among babies of drug-using mothers, regardless of HIV infection. Even the scientific jargon of medical studies cannot hide the tragedies of unborn junkies. 1. At the University of California in San Francisco, the mental development and the coordination of 8 HIV-infected and 6 uninfected infants were observed from 6 to 21 months of age. The mothers of each group were HIV positive and had used intravenous drugs and alcohol during pregnancy. The degree of retardation of the infants correlated directly with the maternal drug consumption. The more cocaine, morphine, and heroin their mothers had used during pregnancy, the more retarded and ill were their children. 2. Another medical school observed that the psychomotor indices, a measure of coordination of infants exposed to substance abuse in utero, were significantly lower than those of non-drug-using mothers, regardless of whether the mothers were HIV positive or not. The researchers concluded that maternal drug use during pregnancy, not HIV, impairs children. 3. 10 HIV-free infants born to intravenous drug-addicted mothers had the following AIDS-defining diseases: failure to thrive, persistent generalized lymphadenopathy, persistent oral candidiasis, and developmental delay. 4. 1 HIV-positive and 18 HIV-free infants born to intravenous drug-addicted mothers had only half as many lymphocytes, white blood cells, at birth as normal controls. At 12 months after birth, the capacity of their white blood cells to proliferate was 50% to 70% lower than that of white blood cells from normal control infants. Yet the AIDS establishment and the news media have exploited these AIDS babies as proof the symptom is contagious, ignoring the drug connection in these unusual infants. Injection drug addicts, male homosexuals, and the children of drug-injecting mothers constitute 94% of all AIDS patients. Thus, the correlation between heavy drug use and AIDS is far better than between HIV and AIDS. Drugs are biochemically active and hence psychoactive every time they are taken, the reason for their popularity. But HIV is inert and dormant in persons with and without AIDS. And although thousands of HIV-free AIDS cases have been described in the medical literature, possibly indicating hundreds of thousands more, no study has ever presented a group of AIDS patients genuinely free of drug use or other AIDS risks, such as hemophilia. Taken together, these facts imply a central role for drug use in AIDS. But there are also experimental reasons to indict these drugs as causes of AIDS. Indeed, each of the major AIDS risk drugs shows evidence of toxicity that could destroy the immune system or cause other AIDS diseases. AIDS through chemistry. Medicine first pioneered the use of alkyl nitrate compounds in the 1860s. Because the substances relaxed muscles and dilated blood vessels, they helped patients with heart diseases, such as angina. These liquids were carried in tiny glass vials that would be broken open to inhale the powerful fumes and thus gain the nickname poppers. Using only these tiny amounts, terminal heart patients never lived long enough to report dangerous health effects. During the 1960s, male homosexuals discovered the aphrodisiac effects of nitrates. Receptive anal intercourse became less painful because the anal sphincter muscle would relax. Therefore, receptive men used far more of the drug than did their insertive partners. Nitrates also helped maintain erections and intensified orgasm, and some users even claimed a euphoric high. The cost at first seemed little more than a brief rush and often a headache. The interest in poppers for sexual purposes soon turned into a stampede, the drug becoming a staple of bathhouse and discotheque life. Bottles of the drug could be purchased in sex shops under such brand names as Rush, Ram, Thunderbolt, Locker Room, Climax, Discorama, and Kryptonite. As described in one research paper, common settings in which these agents are used include the bedroom, parties, back rooms of pornographic bookstores, pornographic theaters, bars, and dance floors. Some users have told us that a few discotheques use special lighting effects to indicate that they are about to spray nitrate fumes over the dance floor. According to Lauritsen and Wilson, with regular use, they become a sexual crutch, and many gay men are incapable of having sex, even solitary masturbation, without the aid of poppers. Nitrate manufacturers, however, managed to sidestep most federal controls by labeling the substance as a room odorizer, and the popper craze took off during the 1970s. Few chemicals are more toxic than nitrates. Sodium nitrate, a much weaker related compound used in tiny amounts as a preservative in meats, has been regulated for years as a potential cancer-causing agent. The alkylated nitrates, poppers on the other hand, react more violently with almost anything. Upon mixing with water, as in the human body, these nitrates form the unstable nitrous acid, which in turn destroys any biological molecules within reach. The nitrates and their breakdown products have long been known to scientists for their ability to mutate DNA, a point recently verified by direct experiment. In addition, nitrates are some of the most powerful cancer-causing chemicals in existence. In contact with living cells, nitrate inhalants are cytotoxic, cell-killing, which means they either poison or kill cells, including, of course, the blood-forming cells and the epithelial lining of the lungs. Since these are among the fastest-growing cells in the body, they will also be among the first cells to be in short supply if the sources are intoxicated. This is the reason that nitrates cause anemia, immunodeficiency, and pneumonia in experimental animals and humans. In view of the toxicity of nitrate inhalants, a prescription requirement was instated by the FDA in 1969. Moreover, the FDA limits nitrates as food preservatives to fewer than 200 ppm because of direct toxicity and because they have been implicated in an increased incidence of cancer. By 1986, a statistical AIDS link to nitrate inhalants had become so convincing to public health officials that the sale of nitrates was banned by the United States Congress in 1988, Public Law 100-690, and by the Crime Control Act of 1990. However, there is no report that nitrate bans are ever enforced or that nitrate warnings are taken seriously. On the contrary, the medical establishment turns a blind eye to drug toxicity in its single-minded pursuit of HIV with safe sex and clean needles. For example, science described nitrate inhalant AIDS links as just another hatch theory in December 1994. As a result, it comes as no surprise that nitrate use continues to remain popular and has even sharply increased recently, particularly among male homosexuals. The reactivity of nitrates easily compares with such toxins as carbon monoxide, the gas that suffocates its victims when a car engine is allowed to run in a closed garage. Carbon monoxide destroys the hemoglobin in blood, preventing oxygen from reaching the body despite normal breathing. Nitrates do the same, a process that can be fatal if too much is inhaled at one time. At the height of the popper craze, for example, a number of overdose victims arrived in hospital emergency rooms with as much as two-thirds of their hemoglobin chemically destroyed. Or to look at nitrates from another angle, a single dose can saturate the person using it with up to 10 million nitrate molecules per cell in the body, leaving plenty of opportunity for damage. But the important question is whether inhaling the drug at sublethal doses for several years can eventually destroy the immune system or cause cancer. Recognizing the universal popularity of nitrates among homosexual men in 1981, the CDC was forced to consider this drug as one possible explanation of the emerging AIDS epidemic. However, the infection-minded CDC officials missed the point of the hypothesis by only searching for a single bad batch of poppers that might have temporarily caused a few sicknesses. It did not even occur to them that nitrates could be toxic by themselves. Therefore, they searched for a contaminated or bad batch of nitrates. When that couldn't be found, they dismissed the hypothesis altogether. The CDC also assumed the effects would show immediately after using poppers, not after years of abuse, the way lung cancer and emphysema follow only after years of smoking tobacco. Naturally, no such contaminated batch could ever be found, and the CDC dismissed the hypothesis altogether and thereafter focused its search entirely on infectious agents. Not all scientists dropped the idea so easily. Some continued testing the proposal that long-term exposure to all nitrates might cause AIDS, and they found some suspicious associations. Kaposi sarcoma, the blood vessel tumor, grabbed some attention for its direct link to the poppers. This AIDS disease almost entirely affected homosexuals, as homosexuals were by far the major consumers of nitrate inhalants, and left heroin addicts, their babies, hemophiliacs, and other AIDS victims untouched. Often the Kaposi's tumor appeared on the face and upper torso and in the lungs of its victims, precisely where the nitrate fumes concentrated the heaviest during use. Before the age of poppers, nobody, not even Moritz Kaposi, had ever diagnosed a pulmonary Kaposi sarcoma, which is a lung cancer. Researchers also discovered that the risk of the tumor was directly proportional to an individual's total lifetime exposure to poppers, regardless of how many venereal or other contagious diseases the person had caught. Interestingly, they estimated that 7 to 10 years of exposure would, on average, produce AIDS roughly the same as the supposed latent period of HIV. Time has borne out the nitrate hypothesis of Kaposi sarcoma. Early public health warnings about the drug's potential effects convinced many homosexual men to stop inhaling it. By 1984, only 58% of homosexual men in San Francisco said they used the drug on a regular basis, dropping to less than half that number by 1991. In parallel, the incidence of Kaposi sarcoma also steadily dropped as a proportion of AIDS cases from half of all AIDS reports in 1981 to only 10% by 1991. This has been the only AIDS disease to decrease this way, a change so shockingly that the CDC itself briefly considered the possibility. In early 1991, that Kaposi sarcoma might be a disease completely independent of AIDS and not caused by HIV. In the end, they retained this tumor on the list of AIDS diseases, correctly assuming few people would pay attention. Reports have now also emerged of young homosexual men with this tumor who have never been infected by HIV, but who do admit to having used poppers. Because the existence of HIV-free AIDS is the most direct threat to the HIV-AIDS hypothesis, only a few such cases have been published in professional journals after the HIV hypothesis had become national dogma in 1984. However, for offering an alternative AIDS virus, some AIDS researchers have been allowed to report Kaposi sarcoma cases free of HIV. For example, a CDC researcher was quoted in the San Francisco Examiner for the discovery of 10 to 30 men who have Kaposi sarcoma but no HIV. Asked for comment, Professor Marcus Conant, one of the University of San Francisco's many AIDS specialists, admitted to the San Francisco Examiner, "At that point, you have to say, well, maybe it could be something else. What could that something else be?" Indeed, such concessions proved to set dangerous precedents for the HIV-AIDS hypothesis because numerous AIDS researchers now felt free to follow the CDC example in reporting their HIV-free AIDS cases at the International AIDS Conference in Amsterdam in 1992. Realizing the imminent danger, the HIV establishment quickly found a new term for such cases: idiopathic CD4 lymphocytopenia, a term that even docile AIDS scientists and reporters had difficulty spelling. And the HIV-free Kaposi cases from the CDC's Dr. Peterman never did appear in a professional journal. In 1993, two healthcare workers, one working at the Public Health Office in San Francisco, the other at Stanford University, told Duisburg, under the condition of anonymity, that they were directed not to report HIV-free AIDS cases as AIDS. Even though the respective patients were from AIDS risk groups and were clinically just like HIV-positive AIDS patients, their diseases were recorded by their old names, i.e. pneumonia, Kaposi sarcoma, tuberculosis, rather than as AIDS. In December 1994, the dam surrounding the HIV-AIDS hypothesis sprang another leak. Again, a new virus was claimed to cause Kaposi sarcoma in HIV-free male homosexuals, as the New York Times and Science reported simultaneously. And all of a sudden, it was okay that 11 out of 21 Kaposi sarcoma patients who had the new virus were free of HIV, considered to be the sole cause of Kaposi sarcoma in the previous 10 years. Apparently, the virus AIDS establishment can accept another AIDS virus in a squeeze, but not a non-viral cause of AIDS. Virus-free AIDS would be a monumental embarrassment for the current AIDS establishment, with far-reaching consequences for prevention, treatment, and education. But another AIDS virus could be absorbed by AIDS educators and therapists with only minor adjustments. The toxicity of nitrates to the cells of the lung and the immune system also explains the proclivity of male homosexual nitrate users for pneumonia, which is the most common AIDS disease in the United States and Europe. The added toxicity of cigarette smoke explains why, among otherwise matched HIV-positive male homosexuals, cigarette smokers develop pneumonia twice as often as non-smokers. Intrigued by the popper's connection, researchers in several laboratories began independently testing long-term exposure in rats or mice to see if the drug could also cause immune deficiency. One CDC research team deliberately used a low dose and carried out the experiment for only a few weeks, finding some side effects but claiming no damage to the rodents' immune systems. But several other labs used higher doses that resembled the heavy recreational use by homosexuals, and their experiments all showed clear destructive effects on the immune system, especially after a few months. In 1983, however, the CDC publicized only its own mouse study, claiming this as proof nitrates were really harmless. The other studies remain hidden in a monograph entitled Health Hazards of Nitrate Inhalants, which was published in 1988 by the National Institute on Drug Abuse. Even today, most AIDS scientists have not even heard of the nitrate research. In lectures or informal conversations, they show curiosity or amazement that human beings would inhale such chemicals. In 1993, the editor of Science Magazine, the most popular journal among researchers, privately expressed to Duisberg his astonishment at the pervasive use of nitrates among homosexual men with AIDS, a group he previously thought had only HIV as a risk factor. Even Gallo, the nation's leading AIDS researcher, as he used to be called by the press, at a May 1994 meeting organized by the National Institute on Drug Abuse in Gaithersburg, Maryland, privately asked his old friend Duisberg, "Tell me, what are these guys using poppers for?" Heroin is another AIDS risk drug with a long history of serious health effects, though not as well studied as the nitrates. Some of this information even dates back to the time opium was smoked rather than injected as heroin. Descriptions of health troubles in drug users date back as far as 1909, often following waves of addiction. Persistent drug users have shown loss of white blood cells, the cornerstone of the immune system, as well as lymph node swelling, fever, rapid weight loss, brain dysfunctions, and dementia, and a marked vulnerability to infections, the classical consequence of immune deficiency. Addicts who inject heroin have classically died from pneumonias, tuberculosis, and other opportunistic infections, as well as from wasting syndromes, all precisely the same AIDS diseases they suffer today. Yet the medical orthodoxy disregards the abundant literature on the health hazards of heroin addiction while defending the unproductive HIV-AIDS hypothesis. In an effort to blame HIV for the ills of heroin addicts, Science recently quoted a dedicated AIDS researcher as saying, "Heroin is a blessedly non-toxic drug." The AIDS establishment regards heroin and all other illicit psychoactive drugs simply as psychological catalysts of risk behavior rather than chemical health hazards on their own. Under the influence of psychoactive drugs, safe sex and safe recreational drug use with clean needles are abandoned in favor of risk behavior, which is thought to risk infection by HIV, the cause of all evil. Cocaine consumption has escalated both in the numbers of consumers and in the dosage consumed. Once mostly inhaled or smoked, it is now often injected intravenously to achieve a higher concentration in the body. Long-term cocaine addicts often develop lung problems, weight loss, and fever, and have proven unusually susceptible to tuberculosis and AIDS disease. In the United States, the epidemics of cocaine use-related diseases and AIDS diseases track so closely together that not even the experts can tell them apart. Narcotic toxicologist W.D. Lerner of the University of Alabama outlined many similarities between the bronchitis and pneumonias of cocaine addicts and AIDS patients in an article, "Cocaine Abuse and Acquired Immunodeficiency Syndrome, A Tale of Two Epidemics." Says Lerner, "Outwardly very dissimilar, they share a number of similarities." But Lerner regrets that with few exceptions, the treatment of drug problems in the United States occurs both figuratively and literally a long distance from the major medical centers. The issue is not a lack of clinical cases, but more likely a lack of scientific reporting of these cases. Lerner pointed out in 1989 that the United States federal government supported just 60 postgraduate research fellowships to investigate the diseases of the 8 million American cocaine addicts, but nearly one fellowship for every one of the more than 10,000 AIDS patients recorded that year. The National Commission on AIDS, appointed by the federal government, likewise documented the many overlaps between the drug and AIDS epidemics in the twin epidemics of substance abuse and HIV. The commission reported in 1991 that 32% of American AIDS patients are from groups that use intravenous drugs such as heroin and cocaine. The commission concluded that AIDS was not spreading into the general population, a point recently echoed in a book entitled Sex in America, A Definitive Survey. And the Journal of Psychoactive Drugs ran an article in 1993 conceding that it was not able to tell apart two entangled epidemics, cocaine use and HIV disease. In 1994, even the New England Journal of Medicine acknowledged intersecting epidemics, crack cocaine use, and HIV infection. A new epidemic of tuberculosis has emerged among cocaine and crack addicts within the past few years. In its press statements, the CDC first assumed the outbreak resulted from the spread of HIV. But upon testing these new tuberculosis cases, it found only a minority of them infected with the virus. Backed into a corner, the CDC smoothly turned the tables by announcing that a new tuberculosis epidemic, parallel to AIDS, was now surfacing and would soon threaten the general public. For decades, however, a significant percentage of the population has been infected by the tuberculosis bacterium, more than 10% of whom never become infected. Populations in the industrial world no longer develop symptoms from tuberculosis because their immune systems are optimally tuned by their high standards of nutrition and health care. Cocaine users, however, particularly those who have become homeless after long-term addiction, seem to have a special inability to fight off disease, forming, in fact, a subculture of persons with immune systems defective from malnutrition and chronic intoxication. Although cocaine and heroin may be blessedly non-toxic drugs in the pages of science, they are unforgivingly toxic for unborn children. During pregnancy, every minute counts for the developing fetus. There is no time to waste on drugs. A completely developed adult can afford to spend a few days in the gutter on his favorite recreational drug without lasting damage. But an unborn child cannot take off even a day from its extremely busy schedule of growing new cells and new organs every day. It is for this reason that babies born to drug-addicted mothers may develop irreversible AIDS diseases in less than 9 months before they are even born. In adults, the grace period of cocaine and heroin addiction that leads to irreversible diseases is much longer, about 5 to 10 years. This is euphemistically called the latent period of HIV by the AIDS establishment. The innocent victims born to cocaine and heroin-addicted mothers have severe mental retardation and other birth defects, as well as bacterial diseases, regardless of whether or not they are infected by their mothers who have HIV. In fact, modern studies that look at heroin and cocaine addicts with tuberculosis, pneumonia, weight loss, oral thrush, chronic diarrhea, and other AIDS diseases typically find that half of them or more have never been infected by HIV, yet all are dying of the same conditions. Sampled from places as diverse as New York and Baltimore, as well as France, Germany, Sweden, and Holland, injection drug abusers manifest pneumonia, tuberculosis, T-cell depletion, and premature death, even without HIV. Even the death rates of HIV-positive and negative addicts are the same. They die at an average age of 30 years. The only common denominator of the high morbidity and mortality of intravenous drug users has been the drug use itself, irrespective of HIV infection. A glance at some medical reports confirms this view exactly. 1. Among intravenous drug users in New York that represent a spectrum of HIV-related diseases, HIV was observed in only 22 out of 50 pneumonia deaths, 7 out of 22 endocarditis deaths, and 11 out of 16 tuberculosis deaths. 2. Pneumonia was diagnosed in 6 HIV-free and in 14 HIV-positive intravenous drug users in New York. 3. Among 54 prisoners with tuberculosis in New York State, 47 were street drug users, but only 24 were infected with HIV.